Okay, how are you all today? Thank you very much for coming out. Thank you to Amy Jo for getting me here and Sue Gorman and the New England School for graciously hosting me. And I really appreciate your time. It's a fantastic turnout for the class, and I'm excited to be back here. I haven't taught at the New England School in about 6 years. So it's really nice and to be back. I live out in the Berkshires, so it's just a couple hours, and it would be nice to have a closer relationship with the school, so I'm excited about that. I recognize a few of you from graduation last summer, so congratulations on that. I hope it's going well, and thanks for coming. So we're going to have a fantastic weekend. I'm going to do everything I can do to make it one of the best classes you've ever taken. And you can reciprocate by giving everything I say the benefit of the doubt till 5 o'clock tomorrow. So giving it the benefit of the doubt just means go with it, and then after 5 o'clock tomorrow, just subject it to as much scrutiny as it takes to determine whether it holds up or doesn't. But till 5 o'clock tomorrow, just sort of go with it and let it in. And of course, if anything I say contradicts anything you know, or if you have anything to add, just raise your hand and we'll talk about it. So I was taught when I was very young that the thing that makes a good scientist is the quality of the questions that are asked. Not the nature of the answers that are gotten, but the quality of the questions. So questions are always good. I will try to be attentive to breaks. Usually I just talk till the last person leaves and then I turn the lights out and go home. We'll try to do breaks. And so there are two ways. There are two kinds of classes that can be taught, and I teach both kinds. One kind is very practical. So for instance, when I'm teaching pulses, when I teach pulse diagnosis, that's very practical with a lot of hands-on and a lot of physiology and theory and a lot of direct sensation. And of course, studying pulse would be like getting a weekend class on pulse would be like getting a weekend class on violin, right? Which would mean no matter how good the class was, you'd have to spend the next 50 years 12 hours a day. And to get humble enough to realize that it was infinite. And at the end of that 50 years, you'd think, oh, I'm just getting started. So Chinese medicine is just like that. In my experience, I started thinking about it in 1975, writing my college entrance essay on it when I was in high school. And so math isn't really my thing, but that's a long time. So, well, you know, I was 17 then, and I'm turning 56 in a few weeks. So that's most of my life. And you can tell how far someone's gotten in Chinese medicine by how humble they are about it, and by how awed they are by how little they really know in relationship to it. So on the one hand, I've thought about it a lot, so I'm going to present to you some of my insights in this regard. And on the other hand, you know, it's infinitely deep, which is why it's so fulfilling, right? It's not really something, people are called masters, but it's not really anything that can be mastered. So I would appreciate it if people did not record this. I am recording it, and if you friend me on Facebook, I will post a link to, if not all of the audio, to much of it. And I'll put it up for free on my website. Okay, but I don't like people to record it. In the old days when it was, you know, cheap cassette decks, I didn't mind. But now that you can rearrange my words and put it on the internet, it makes me nervous. So I'll just put it up. And of course, if you're savvy, you can take that, rearrange my words, and put it on the internet. But but at least I'll have first dibs. Okay, so one kind of class you can teach is very, very practical in the technical sense. What I'm teaching this weekend is perspective. So the thing about technique is when you learn technique, it tends to be mostly lateral development. Lateral development means you're learning something new, but you're thinking about it in exactly the same way you've always thought about it. So you've sort of grown laterally. So it would be like being a banjo player and learning a new banjo tune. You're still playing banjo. If you play banjo, I'm sorry. You know what they say proper pitch is for a banjo? 40 feet into a dumpster. I could spend the weekend just telling banjo jokes, but I won't do that. So I'm more interested in this weekend in perspective, which means vertical development. So the thing is, if you step, you can grow laterally forever. And most people do. Most people get to somewhere between 18 to 21. And then everything they learn the rest of their life is just assimilated into that worldview. They can live to be 105, but they're looking at things at 105 exactly like they did when they were 18, 19, 20, 21. Right? Most people, the music they're listening to, and they love the rest of their life, is whatever they love between 14 to 16. So that's just called lateral growth. So what I'm interested in the context of this course is more vertical growth. So the thing is, even if we could get perspective to shift 1 millimeter vertically, that means everything you already knew would be recontextualized, but from a higher perspective. And because spirit has two directions, when we say higher, we also mean deeper. Right? So hopefully this class won't just be more information. My goal in this class, hello David, my goal in this class would be to increase perspective. And what I hope to accomplish is to have some significant component of that increase to be vertical, which means deeper and higher. And higher and deeper always mean more inclusive. So that more inclusive means that you can understand more things that you observe in a greater context with more inclusivity, more integrity, more complexity. Being able to, the higher you go, the more complexity you can cognize. So in that regard, if you just look at this picture, this is a picture, we relate to this picture only in terms of medicine, but what this picture is actually a picture of is the relationship between the one and the many. And because we live in a dualistic world, the one is in two places in that picture. So where is the one in that picture? Well, the one is the whole thing. So we see a pattern divided into 5, divided into 12, and each of the 12 contains an implicit image of the one. Just like your body. So the cell in your nose and a cell in your basal ganglia of your brain and a cell in your liver and a cell in your eye all have different structures and functions, but they all have the same DNA. We could clone you from any one of them. So in each cell, in each part of you, there is an implicit picture of the whole, a referent to the whole in each of the holons. A holon is a whole that's complete, that is made up of other wholes that are smaller, and itself comprises a larger whole. So all electrons in the universe are a holon, and all protons are a holon, and all neutrons and neutrinos are a holon, right? They're all complete unto themselves. An atom is a holon. An amino acid is a complete thing. Lysine or arginine are complete unto themselves, but then they make up proteins which are complete, and the proteins make up cellular structures, a mitochondria which is complete. All mitochondrias form a holon. And then a cell, a single cell, and a nucleated cell with a wall is a holon. And then all the cells make up the liver, which is a whole, complete unto itself. In relationship to other holons, such as the spleen, the kidney, the heart, the liver, the bladder, the kidney, those are each holons. And all those holons make up a person, and all individuals comprise a holon, and they are a culture in a biosphere, on a planet, in a universe. And it's holons all the way up and holons all the way down. And they all are part and parcel of, and in no way separate from, the one thing that is happening in the universe at any one moment. So we can say that the individual exists in that circle. The one is that whole circle. But we can also say the one is the dead center of that circle, right in the middle of that little wheel. And you're in both places. So there's part of you, which is your consciousness, which we call Shen, Shen small s, which is out there in that wheel. And it is that wheel in that regard to your individual life, your Shen small s, your memory, your thoughts, your feelings, your emotions, the conclusions you drew about your experiences. That psychological self is out there in that wheel, and it is being impacted by weather, thought, feeling, and emotion. Right? Weather, thought, feeling, and emotion. And you are being stirred by a current through that circle. And you are being stirred by that circle by the same thing that is creating seasonal change. Right? So the seasons, they go round and round. The painted ponies, they go up and down. We're all riding on the carousel of time. Right? That circle is time. Eight principles is space. I'll draw that diagram later. I should have given it to you. But the circle is time, and you are out in it. And you might notice that your emotions tend to cycle. And, you know, we feel fear and we feel anger and we feel joy and sorrow and we feel worry and we feel need and we feel longing and we feel grief. And they go round and round and round and round. And one of the things I've noticed in my clinical practice is that human beings, to the degree that they're conditioned and unconscious, lack any context in their life other than what their experience is in the moment. So whatever a person happens to feel in the moment, they relate to it as if it's what they've always felt, feel now, and will always be feeling. So as a clinician, you can see that people will tell you 37 treatments in a row that they are getting better and better, and they'll come in one week and they'll say, this treatment isn't working, nothing's happening. Why? Because I felt like I did 23 months ago. Before I started. Well, how long have you felt that way? 3.5 minutes. So nothing's happened. Do you see? It's just the clinical reality. People tend to be caught up in this wheel, being stirred through it. This is called, the Taoist metaphor for this would be being stirred through life in a whirlpool. Having the outcome of your life fated and determined by forces that are acting on you, on us, that we are experience ourselves as being victims of, like a cork bobbing on the ocean or a leaf in the wind. The outcome of most human beings' lives is being shaped by forces they're unaware of and that they don't understand, that they're all caught up in, and they can't see because they're so identified with that movement. They're so identified with the movement that they mistake that movement for who and what they are. So when they have thoughts, they have feelings, they have emotions, when there's weather, when there's seasonal change, they identify with it and they see it as self. So when qi moves outside of us, there's weather. When qi moves inside of us, there's thought, feeling, emotion, sensation. If you saw someone personalizing the weather, you'd think they were schizophrenic. It's so gray today. I can't even remember what the sun looks like. it's always going to be like this. Go, what? You crazy? You probably help the person by slapping them in the face. Forget subtle point selection. Go, wake up! What are you, nuts? You got a family, life is good. You live in the most privileged demographic of people who've ever lived. The fact that you guys are here today because you want to be and can afford to be, you can afford the time and you can afford the money to be here just because you want to come, means that you live in a demographic of people where the outcome of your individual life is shaped more by the choices you make than any other humans in history. And that includes the emperors and the pharaohs and the kings of old. The emperor in China couldn't do what he wanted just because he wanted to. I think I'll go for a walk. Think Obama can do that? You think Obama can? I'm going to go down to the local basketball court and see if I can get a pickup game. Well, he can do that, but there are 12 guys with Glocks and earpieces and sunglasses and snipers on all the rooftops, right? And drones probably overhead. So we have a lot of freedom. So the Chinese characters, the Chinese for this wheel is the Sheng cycle. Sheng means birth. Do people know what samsara is? Well, samsara is ignorance, illusion. It's what uses up lifetime after lifetime after lifetime when people are embedded out in the circle, misidentifying themselves as what's going on in the circle, losing themselves in it. The Chinese characters for samsara are sheng, the same sheng cycle, sheng, birth, and then si, death. So this is the samsara. And that's where Shen's small s, the psychological self, is embedded as a victim of the forces out in that cycle. So we have birth in water, death in metal. And the Taoist image is of being swept. The Big Dipper is a spoon in the sky sweeping individuals, stirring, mixing us, sending us along. Birth, death, birth, death, birth, death, birth, death. So part of us is out in that cycle, that Shen, spirit, but in this sense, spirit with a small s means psychology, the psychological self, the part of the mind that stores thought, feeling, sensation, emotion, conclusion, that we use to orient us to the world. So it's good to be oriented out in the world. You say, Lonnie, I say yes. It's good for me to know that my car is parked in front of the building across the street, right? So I can get home tonight and remember to come back in and remember where the Berkshires are when I drive back. So being oriented in time and space is a good thing. But when we lose ourselves out in the circle and we identify exclusively with everything that's going on out there, our actions in life tend not to be so much driven by our higher aspirations, but more by conclusions that the mind has drawn selfishly in relationship to only the psychological self that's living out in that circle. Which means the action, we get acted upon by forces and then through our own actions perpetuate the spinning of that wheel so it goes faster and faster and faster. And then we forget that we have a choice in relationship to our experience. Even when we think we're making choices, those choices are just largely determined by genetic and cultural conditioning. Right? So when a 42-year-old woman wakes up at 3 o'clock in the morning on a Tuesday and decides that even though she doesn't have kids and hasn't wanted them her whole life, that if all of a sudden she realizes I only have a year and a half or two left, my life won't have meaning unless I have a kid. Is that a freely made choice, or is that being determined by a genetically programmed movement? Right? When a 40 or 50-year-old guy with two kids decides that he's going to leave his family for whatever, for the 21-year-old secretary, is that a choice being freely made Or is that a choice being determined by genetics, culture? Right? It's just a choice that's being given. It's being made by a machine, right? Not being made by the deepest self. It's just cause and effect out in a circle. So I gave two dramatic examples, trying to give men and women equal time and equal heat for this, but we're all culpable. So there's another place that who we are, and that's Shen Largesse. And Shen Largesse is this point at the center of the circle, the single point of consciousness, which isn't your consciousness. The illusion is that it's your consciousness. It's just consciousness. Consciousness. And it's aware, it can potentially be, when we wake up to it, aware of everything that's happening out in the circle. So I know I'm the one, you're the one, who are you? You say, who am I? Well, you're who's ever hearing me speak right now. So what's ever hearing me speak, what's ever seeing me, what's ever writing on the paper, that's consciousness. And one can, and it doesn't take very long, arrive at a point, even when I'm speaking about it, you have a capacity to do this, is you can start to experience thoughts, feelings, sensations, emotions, conclusions, and the weather as just objects in awareness that have no self nature. Do you see? They're just, so thoughts, feelings, emotions, sensations, conclusions become objects in awareness that have no self nature. Now, I've noticed with my patients, and most people in general, that as human beings, we have a tendency, and it's one of my definitions of craziness is when a patient identifies with thoughts, feelings, emotions, and sensations they're having and speaks about them as if they were true just because they're having them. But if anyone else in the world said the same words to them, they'd never want to talk to the person again. So a patient will come in, and I will say, what are you here for? Say, I'd like to lose 50 pounds. But I'm never going to be able to do it. I've dieted 4 times before. I can lose some weight, but then I go back on. I have no willpower. And they tell me this as if it's true. But I know if they met, some friend for breakfast or lunch before the appointment, and the friend said, why are you in town? And the patient said, I'm going to acupuncture. I want to lose 50 pounds. And the friend said, wait a second, you've dieted 3 times before, you can lose weight, but you always put it back on, you have no willpower. What's the point? Say, F you. They'd never want to talk to the person again. So it's interesting that there seems to be a mechanism in human beings that when thought, feeling, emotion, and sensation and conclusion is experienced internally, it's immediately identified with as truth and spoken with verbally and acted on. But if anyone else in the world said it, they'd say, what are you nuts? How rude. Do you see? So there's something in place. There's something in place that's causing this identification, this misappropriation of identification, this misappropriation of attention. Away from the source of self, the source is this one point at the center of the circle. So in reality, there is no difference and there is no separation between the single point of consciousness at the center of the circle and that field of consciousness that's out in the circle. They're just one thing. But there is a mechanism that causes the illusion of separation so that an individual forgets that they're the consciousness at the center of the circle, the consciousness that is seeing everything, that's experiencing everything, the consciousness that is free of the objects in its awareness. It forgets that it's watching a movie. It starts to think it's in the movie. and it starts to respond as though it's an actor in the movie. This is just the first few pages of the Bhagavad Gita. Right? So Krishna and Arjuna are in chariot on a battlefield, and Arjuna turns to his charioteer and he says, I can't go to war. I see my brother, my uncle, my cousin over there. This is my family on the other side of the battlefield. And the charioteer reveals himself to be Krishna, and he gives him a view of the universal self. And he said, these are not your brothers, your uncles. Right? You're not really here. You're this single point. You're this infinite field of the one consciousness in the universe. You're just here fulfilling a role. Nothing's really being done. So he gives them this universal view. Now, in terms of the moral implications of what the Vedantists, the conclusions they drew in relationship to nothing's being done, I didn't buy it when I was 13 and I don't buy it now. Right? Well, go kill your brother and your uncle and your cousin. It's all a great play. So you get Charles Manson then, who says, well, if it's all one, then I didn't do anything. Right? But we can still go, we don't have to draw the same conclusions as the Bhagavad Gita, that it's all an illusion. It is all an illusion from the perspective of the unborn. It's all an illusion. That point at the center of the circle, consciousness can see everything happening out here and say, it's not me, it's not real. Ramana Maharshi said, I am that. I am that one consciousness at the center. I am that. I'm not here. I am not this body. The entire, my body is a metaphor for the world. My body is the microcosm of the universe, and the universe doesn't really exist. All that exists is consciousness, right? Emptiness and luminosity. And that is an important point of view, and it's important to see it, but it's not the only perspective. It's one perspective. It's not an ultimate destination in the 21st century. Right? If everybody woke up to Ramana Maharshi's perspective, the world would be a more peaceful place, but it wouldn't do a thing to give us the new kind of global economic systems, educational systems, social systems, the higher values regarding the environment that we need to fulfill our destiny as a race on the planet, one living in harmony with nature and taking everything further in a positive way. In a positive way. So we are this consciousness at the center of the circle, and that we can call that emptiness. So I've referred to this mechanism that causes us to lose focus on that, to lose identification with that, to forget it. Isn't it clear that a newborn infant has that? For a newborn infant, there's no difference between the baby's mouth and the mother's nipple. It's just one thing. There's no you and me. There's just one thing happening. One thing. So we lose that. We lose that perspective. We become lost out in the wheel. We go through life reacting. And we're going to cover this weekend how that looks in different stages. Why that happens, how it happens. And we're going to endeavor to understand that process, differentiating it according to the system. Now, if we take a prism and we shine a single light through that prism, that single light at the center of the circle, so if we imagine this to be a diamond or a prism and we shine the single light of consciousness through it, we can look at the rainbow on the wall and we can say blue, green, red, yellow, white in the rainbow. But we have to remember, and we always know, that we're making distinctions, but they're all implicit attributes. They're named distinctions in a single light, in a single source of light. There's no difference. There's a difference out in the world materially in terms of point selection, herbal formula selection, dietary selection. There's a different manifestation in terms of facial characteristics and maybe lab tests. So there's different physical manifestations, but all those manifestations are just named distinctions in what is a projection of one light, and that one light is consciousness. Now, it is my experience, with my students when they first come to me, with my patients. I've been in full-time practice almost 30 years, so just short of 30 years. So I've seen a lot of people. And it is my impression that most people are significantly unaware of the different dimensions of the self. And that 99 to 99.9% of an individual's attention and identification are associated with what's going on out in the circle. And all of that is given by genetics and culture. It's programmed. It's a mechanical, mechanistic relationship to life in which there is not significant freedom to make choices based on higher values. So the outcome of most people's lives is determined by their past. And to me, the highest purpose, the deepest purpose of medicine, on a non-physical level, the highest and deepest purpose, because of course we want to save life, we want to improve quality of life, we want to take people out of pain, sure, of course, but the highest and deepest purpose is we would like the outcome of an individual's life to be shaped not by genetic and cultural forces that they do not understand or are unaware of. We want the outcome of a person's life to be formed by their striving toward the highest truth that has been revealed to them. We want people's, who a person becomes, to be informed by the future they're trying to create, not by their past. So what I've noticed is most people come in and they have a significantly victimized relationship to life, to their own history, and that what, no matter how old they are, 20, 30, 40, 50, 60, 70, 80, 90, by 90, most people are either really far gone or they've developed a sort of philosophical sense of humor about the whole thing. Okay? But for people between 20 to the late 80s, whatever amount of life they have left is allocated to overcoming whatever part they've already lived. And that isn't living. That isn't living. And I don't want a healthcare, I don't want to see a healthcare practitioner who's in a process of healing. I want to see a healthcare practitioner who's come to a point in their own development where they are done healing. Okay, that doesn't mean their body's perfectly healthy, because nobody's body is perfectly healthy. Nobody's ever. Now, you may have the illusion of that when you're, you know, between the age of 13 to 28, or 32, or even 40, but as a pulse diagnostician, even when people look really good and they're running on all burners and everything's great, I mean, you know, you can usually find a disaster or two in the making, something 20, 30, 40 years out. So it's good to practice preventive medicine. So what I've noticed is that people love healing. So by that I mean they love acupuncture, they love herbs, they love moxa, they love tai chi and qigong and ayahuasca and tantric sex. They love dancing in the desert, they love going to Burning Man, they love talking about themselves $150 an hour for an hour in psychotherapeutic terms means 45 minutes. So 45 is the new 60 in therapy. And they love chocolate mud packs and drinking all sorts of esoteric things. So they love that, they love it, and they love seeking, because under the auspices of seeking, they can consume a lot of experience. But what I've noticed is most people don't look very deeply into their experience, find a moral imperative in it, and then change their life according to what they've seen. What they tend to do is have an amazing experience and then want more of that. You see? Then they want more of that. And so if somebody's a seeker for 10 years, that's very impressive. You say they're earnest. And if they're a seeker for 20 years, you know, they're not giving up. But by the time someone's a seeker for 30 years, you got to start getting suspicious. And by the time someone's a seeker for 40 years and they haven't become a finder, you have to draw the conclusion is they just like workshops. They like traveling. They like good food. They like workshops. They like telling everybody their life story over and over and over and over again. But that they, the part of them that's consuming all this experience under the auspices of healing actually has no sincerity in regard to being healed at the level of the soul, at the level of conscience and consciousness. So the thing is, how long does it take for that kind of healing to happen? And it would take about this long. So all your life, your attention, one's attention, all our lives, our attention has been here. This is how long it takes. Oh, I was never really this, right? So genetics and culture have over 50, 100, 150,000 years, arguably maybe a billion years if you want to go back to a single cells. Right, because you can take a single cell, put it in a Petri dish, and apply heat at one end, and it'll move away heat from heat, or put sugar at the other end, and it will move toward the sugar. So even a single cell will flee from what it fears and what makes it uncomfortable, and go toward what it craves and desires. So you could say we have a billion years of genetic conditioning, and 4,000 to 50,000 years of cultural conditioning that reinforce this illusion that who we are is what's out in that wheel. But it's merely a shift of identification. And in terms of what the Vedantists or the Buddhists or the Taoists call, or the Muslims called enlightenment, even the Christians or the Jews, what they called enlightenment would be the breakdown of that filter, of that machine, of that mechanism that is stubbornly holding all of our attention out in the wheel on what's ever going on out there. The breakdown of it for a second, a minute, an hour, 2 hours, a day, a week, a month, a year, however long the experience lasts, that filter breaks down. One consciousness itself for a moment transcends the filter, and all of a sudden, all of one's consciousness sucks back out of that wheel to the center of the circle, and you go, boom! And then you're like Jodie Foster in that movie, Contact, out there in space where she goes through the wormhole, and there's this moment where, boom, she can see the whole thing, and her mind is totally blown, and she sees spiral galaxies, and she's just, right? So she's shooting through a wormhole, and everything stops for a moment, and it's like, go, oh my God. That's what I am. That's who I am. I've never really been this thing in this body. And consciousness can shift and realize, oh, I'm the whole thing. I'm not separate from the whole thing. The science of Chinese medicine is significantly based on a principle which the Buddhists call dependent origination. So you can Google dependent origination. If you want to understand this medicine, you need to have a big worldview. And you need to study philosophy, religion, culture. Right? Because the medicine is just providing context. It's not, the medicine isn't a machine. The medicine is a way of knowing people in relationship to genetics, in relationship to history, in relationship to culture. When I diagnose a patient, my question is, where is this consciousness in its development? How lost is it, and to what degree is it lost? And how are the ways in which it's lost and the degree to which it's lost contributing to the pathology that's occurring out there in the body as vehicle? So this picture is a picture of the relationship between the one and the many. The one is that center of the circle. The many are those 60 dots out in the wheel. From the position of those dots, you have your truth, I have my truth, nobody knows the truth. So wood within kidney has its point of view, and metal within kidney has its point of view, and water within our spleen has its point of view, and fire within wood has its point of view, and there are 60 points of view, and all of them are relative, and everyone's looking at the center of the circle, seeing something different. So we're used to considering the perspective of the many on the one, what's the perspective of the one on the many? It's the same step back to the center of the circle, no matter where you are out in it. And when you get there, it's the same experiences. All of a sudden, the one can see through the many. And what seems so complex when you are embedded in it, your own special problem that's unique. Every patient I've ever seen has this thesis. What happened to me wouldn't have affected other people as strongly as it did me, but it affected me the way it did because I'm so sensitive. Which is a complete devaluation and dehumanization of everybody else. I'm the sensitive one, and I have this special problem, fill in the blank, X, Y, Z. My mommy did this, my daddy did that, my husband did this, my wife did that, my lover did this, my brother did that, my sister, right? The only thing different is the names, the dates, the places. So when I started treating people clinically, I was at first enthralled with how unique everybody was. All these fascinating people and their stories. If you pay attention in clinical practice, after 2 years, the only thing that's different is the names, the dates, the places. And for all the differentiation you do, is the person kidney or is the person lung or is the person heart? Okay, so the difference is if they're kidney, you're doing kidney 3. And if they're heart, you're doing heart 7, but you're still doing a source point. Do you see? The only thing really different are the names, the dates, the places. Everybody has the story. Something happened to me. It defined me. This is who I am. Based on what happened, here's the conclusion I drew, which may be conscious or unconscious. This is who I am. This is how life is. And this is how I'm going to survive it. And I need to overcome what happened to me. I need to overcome it, and I'll know that I've overcome it when I don't feel fear, anger, sorrow, worry, or grief anymore. And the fact that I'm still feeling fear, anger, sorrow, worry, grief is proof that I still have more work to do. Do you see? And I'm really sincere, so I'm willing to spend the rest of my life doing that work. I don't care if it kills me, and it will, because at some point you'll still be feeling those emotions, and you'll be 107, and then you'll die. Right? So how long does it take to overcome it? Well, it takes this long. It goes, okay, I'm done. Right? You lose interest. The Tao Te Ching says the sage is not sick because the sage is sick of being sick. And the main sickness we have today, the main sickness at a spiritual level would be narcissism, which is a total focus on our own process, our own internal process. So all our attention is being usurped and focused by this mechanism. The mechanism is a filter. We'll talk about it at length. And it keeps all our attention focused on I, me, and mine in this hall of mirrors out in the wheel. So we can say that what this picture is actually showing us is it's a relationship between consciousness, the one consciousness in this universe, the patient's consciousness, and the body, physiology, culture, biosphere, and cosmos. So what this chart actually does is it locates the individual consciousness of the patient within biology, physiology, culture, biosphere, and cosmos. It's the relationship between the one and the many. It's the most sophisticated, nuanced holographic model ever devised in humanity. And it's the most sophisticated basis of a medicine and approach to understanding where an individual is, where they're stuck, where they need to move on to. But the point isn't just to get people going around that circle. The point of the medicine is to free them from it. And because because Chinese medicine came to the West in a very large way, it had been here for 300 years. It came over in 1660. Jesuits went to China and came back to France. So, and brought the text with them. Wilhelm Leibniz, the German philosopher who created integral and differential calculus, published them before Newton, and invented binary math, did it while reading the I Ching with a Jesuit scholar. And in the I Ching, you have a broken line, a solid line, a broken becoming a solid, or a solid becoming a broken. And based on that, he invented binary math, and he came up with the first holographic system in the West called monadology, which you can Google and get a translation of. M-O-N-O-D-O-L-O-G-Y, monadology. It might be M-O-N-A-D, I'm not sure. And in it he said that every atom in the universe has an implicit image of every other atom in the universe, that the universe is made of atoms, and that every part has all the information you'd need about every other part. Okay? So that was based on reading the I Ching. So the dharmas started to come together. And what I'm presenting to you is a relatively advanced synthesis of East and West coming together. But a synthesis transcends the limitations of each but recognizes the strength. So I'm presenting something to you that is an emergent worldview. Emergent means that I'm not lecturing from notes. I'm just talking, and hopefully it's new. So you have to go with it till tomorrow at 5, and then you have to spend some time and think, did any of that make any sense? But the problem is that what the machine does, what the filter does, is the filter says, how was that workshop? And the filter says, it was great, but it's going to take a while to incorporate back into my life. And that's the filter talking. The filter is saying, when the filter says, I need to incorporate it back into my life, it means my intention is to disregard everything that could result in vertical evolution and only assimilate into my life what confirms what I already know and believe. Because the main function of the filter is to preserve the status quo, to orient us in time and space relative to a known reality, to help us create the illusion of security in what is a very uncertain world. Okay, I think we covered the basics. So that orients philosophically toward the system. I'm lecturing from three points of view this weekend. I'm not going to sort out for you the real location of liver 14 or where spleen 6 really is or how to treat shin splints with gallbladder 34. So this is a class on philosophy, on perspective, on overarching perspective. My perspective would be this would be the first class taken when a new student walks in. This would be the lecture they'd get the first day. And not just in relationship to five element, but in relationship to the overarching view of what's the relationship between five element and eight principles. We can do that very quickly. We look at a Chinese coin. There's the five elements. Okay, that's time. That's the ticking of a clock. And there's the square, that's space. So we have a XYZ axis, and we have excess, deficiency, I'm dyslexic, so I study too much Chinese, and sometimes I write English words backwards, it's weird. So anyway, external, internal, we'll make this the front, okay? Hot, cold, okay. You can generate all the syndrome patterns by moving a dot in those dimensions. Okay? So you can have internal deficient heat, you can have internal excess heat, you can have external excess cold, you can have external deficiency with presence of heat. So this is just thermodynamics. So the eight principles, yin-yang thinking, applied to the eight principles, is Chinese thermodynamics. So when you make a statement that a person is exposed to wind cold, the cold gets into the body raises heat. To push the cold out, pushes some of it out, but can't push all of it out. And the heat consumes fluid over time because it's pushing out the cold. It creates stagnation. The stagnation means things aren't moving. The body works to move the stagnation. There's friction. It creates heat. The heat consumes fluid. The lungs become yin deficient. The kidney provides yin to the lungs. The kidney becomes yin deficient, the liver heats up, generates fire, disturbs the heart, there are heart palpitations. This pool ball hit that pool ball, hit this pool ball, hit. It's just cause and effect, linear thinking. It's why that kind of thinking was significantly adopted by the Chinese and not five-element thinking. Not five element, but eight principles, because eight principles is linear, and the Chinese were trying to get rid of myth and superstition and come into the 20th century and adopt Western scientific principles. And this kind of cause and effect thinking in space, thermodynamics, and things existing in space, materialism, material world. Marxism is dialectical materialism. Mao in 48 said we have to revive the tarnished Chinese medicine, which is a treasure house, and we have to remove the tarnish and restore it according to the principles of dialectical materialism. Dialectical materialism means we're going to talk about what's physically real, right? So we're going to talk about what exists in time, in space. Anyway, so that's the relationship, the circle and the square. And of course, at the center, we have emptiness. So at the center, we have emptiness. And when we meditate to appreciate emptiness, we have two qualities, emptiness and luminosity. Luminosity is consciousness, and emptiness is just empty. We have consciousness and emptiness. Okay, so I'm going to present everything I'm talking about is from three points of view this weekend. I'm presenting an integral point of view. Integral means a few things practically. Sri Aurobindo coined the term integral in the early part of the last century. He formed integral yoga. And what he meant by integral yoga was a practice, a developmental practice, which left no part of the human being behind. It left no part of the human being behind. So integral means that an integral medicine means we're going to practice a medicine. We aspire to practice a medicine which leaves no part of the patient behind. And the other half of that then implicates us. To treat multiple sclerosis, you don't have to have had it. To help get a woman pregnant, you don't have to have been pregnant. On a physical level, you do not have to have suffered from what you are treating. But you can only liberate consciousness to the degree that your consciousness is free. You can't take anyone further developmentally in terms of their own interiority to any more of a degree than you've traveled yourself. And as I was saying before, I've noticed most people are really ignorant of the different dimensions of themselves. Most people will know that they're having a thought and a feeling, but there's no recognition that they're only that who they are is the one aware of the thought and feeling, and that they're not the thought and feeling. Most people, their consciousness is identified with the thought and feeling, so they define themselves as the thought and feeling. How are you today? Person will tell you how they're feeling. Right? So, I mean, if you said to Martin Luther King, when he was doing that walk down to Selma, Alabama, and they were spraying him with fire hoses and unleashing the German shepherds, "How are you today?" What would he have said? You think he would have said really crappy? He would have said straight ahead, right? So, you know, in the Bible, there's this parable where Christ is walking down the road with his disciples, and one of the disciples says, "I want to come with you," meaning I recognize you and I want to travel with you to fulfill our shared destiny, but I have to bury my father first. Christ says, "Let the dead bury the dead, everybody else straight ahead. We got somewhere we're going." If you had said to Christ when he was being crucified, "How are you? Why do you think?" I mean, it was a crappy day. It couldn't have been any. Would have had to been really rough, right? Would have had to be really rough. But he says, "Father, into your hands I commend my soul," which means he has absolute faith in the highest that he's seen. David. You can leave the crap behind. It wasn't exactly my point in relationship to that story. But you can leave what's not real behind. What's not real isn't really part of who you are. So are the contents of your large intestine part of the self? No, they're going to be eliminated. They're recognized by your entire being as not self. That's why they're in the large intestine. Do you understand? So we can leave that behind. We don't have to bring Justin Bieber with us to heaven. And we can still have integral philosophy. That's the short answer. We don't have to bring banjos. Again, no offense meant if you like folk music. I'm just joking. Kind of. Okay, so, yes. So integral means that we want a medicine that aspires to capture all of who the patient is with no part left behind, and to do that we have to implicate every part of our own self, which means as practitioners, the foundation of being a practitioner for me is to what degree is a person woken up to the other dimensions of themselves. Chinese medicine can be completely abstract. There are people in our field who've written a lot of books, and their entire relationship to the material is totally intellectually abstract. They could talk about Hun and Po and what ancient text it was cited in and what the characters mean in the context of that sentence, but they have absolutely no relationship in terms of their own experience internally to that dimension of the self or how to take responsibility for it or what the implication is. And to know that, you just have to look at their lives. You just have to look at their lives. Or look, listen to how they're speaking. So being a scholar doesn't necessarily mean that your relationship is abstract, but it can be. It can be, and it is for lots of people. So I would say that if I was licensing acupuncturists, I would get rid of the national exam, because that is just a test of your knowledge of medical anthropology. It doesn't have much to do with what it takes to treat a human being in the 21st century. It's medical anthropology is seen through the eyes, most significantly really of Marxists. And I would just be concerned with how much depth does a person have? How awake are they? How awake are they to these different dimensions of the self beyond the conditioned mind? And how much responsibility are they taking for them? Do you want to go to a healer whose most significant identification in life is with a part of them that is inherently limited and that is wounded and sees itself as traumatized and victimized? I wouldn't want to. It's not a project I want to be involved with. So a significant dimension of integral means that we're going to address all of who the patient is with all of who we are, and we recognize that our own integrity, therefore, integral means integrity, we therefore recognize that our own integrity is the forms the basis of our efficacy in treatment. That what we know, the technical information and the scholarly information, the knowledge that we have, is a vehicle that serves who we are. So it's significantly important that no matter how much a person knows, what's more important is the context they're looking at that from. And if they're looking at it only from the perspective of a wounded self out in the circle, that's not very good. That's not very good. So we want to develop ourselves as practitioners to the point that who we are becomes a force in the treatment room, independent of what we know. We want to become the type of human being who our patients find it impossible to be cynical in front of, about their own capacity to transcend their own limitations and to manifest potential beyond their wildest imaginations in the world. We want them to be free. And we want to be the living proof that is possible, because even if their mind is totally cynical about their capacity to do it, the best part of themselves is going to align with the best part of us before we've even put a needle in. Before we've even really said a word. So John Coltrane said that he wanted to be a force in the world for the truly spiritual, for what's true, what's good, what's beautiful. And Duke Ellington was given three wishes. They said, if you had three wishes, what would you wish for? And he said, only the very best. Only the best. So that's who we want to be. There is a dimension of ourselves which is that. So integral implicates the whole patient. It implicates all of us. And when we're really understand this, there's no difference between us and the patient. There's just one patient. There's just one practitioner. There's no separation. We're in it together. We're in it together. And the process of treatment means that we are going somewhere together. So to me, that's integral. Now, there's a lot more. I could lecture the next week 8 hours a day on integral. But this is the essence of what it means. And then the rest of it is philosophy flushing that out in the world with very sophisticated models. And if you wanted one book to read on that, Ken Wilber's book, A Theory of Everything, would be a good start. That book, A Theory of Everything, lies out the overarching philosophical context which is emergent and leading edge at this point in history. The meta context, the overarching context that assimilates all other contexts that have emerged in the traditional cultures but cover different domains. This overarching integral context synthesizes them, shows the domains of efficacy of each in relationship to each other. I'm also talking from an evolutionary perspective. I could talk a week on that. Very simply, evolutionary means that the context of treatment, the recognized context of life, of human life, and of universal development is one of development without end. So we could talk all about evolution, physical evolution, spiritual evolution. It could be an entire course. I could teach a year-long course here on evolution and its relationship to medicine. But what you basically have to get is we're getting rid of the idea of end state. All of the traditions had an end state. In the Western traditions, you died and you went to heaven. And in the Eastern traditions, you became enlightened. And going to heaven was the end of development. Right? It's the end of development. And becoming enlightened meant end of development. And we're just going to say, okay, we recognize because we recognize quantum mechanics and nuclear physics and deep time development. And we know that the Earth isn't just 6,000 years old because we have trees that are older than that. We recognize deep time development. We look through the Hubble telescope and something in us, the part of us that responds when we look at the pictures from the Hubble telescope, is the part of us that is that. That is part and parcel of the entire process. When you see those galaxies out there, that was you 14 billion years ago. That's where all your atoms were. Physics tells us that, right? So that was us. So it's interesting that what's looking through the Hubble telescope, the telescope itself, and what's being seen on the other side of it are the same thing. Do you understand? So what's the difference between a trilobite, the first trilobite opening an eye in the bottom of the ocean? Wouldn't that have been amazing a billion years ago? That after 13 billion years an eye opens? But it's nothing compared to the Hubble telescope. We're vehicles that built the... Matter evolved to the point where you could get a vehicle so that the universe could see its own origin. It's fascinating, right? It's fascinating. It's awesome. If you really let that into your heart, you realize, oh God, I'm a vehicle for the universe awakening to its own origin. Right? Okay, so evolutionary just means we recognize that in terms of our relationship to ourselves and our patients, we're responsible for development without end. And our goal with a patient is to treat them for development without end. This model arose in Taoism, and it's a model that depicts merging with, becoming one with. That's significant, but it isn't going far enough. There's a difference between recognizing I am that and getting in the driver's seat and taking responsibility for it than just realizing that I am that. The Taoist view was there's a river flowing, I am just a leaf in the river, I'm merging with it, dissolving into the river, and I'm going willy-nilly, which are the actual translation of the Chinese characters, here and there, wherever it takes me. That's very different from saying, I have seen the mountaintop, and I'm going to give everything to getting there. I'm taking the whole process there. You see? It's what Martin Luther King said. Human beings are the only form of matter, as far as we know, that can see the potential of a greater future and create it. Right? So in a way, we're the only self-determining matter in the universe. We have some measure of free will. Now, I would never say that we have 100% free will. Nobody is that. There's always conditioning. But even if we just have 1% free will, if you get 51% of your attention on the 1% that's free, you can make a choice inspired by your highest goals. Then your whole attention shifts from overcoming the past to creating a better future. And when that happens, the Taoists would say that wheel starts spinning backwards, which is actually the directions the elements go in the womb, in the fetus. They go the opposite direction. Right? Very, very interesting. Okay. So the last thing is I'm talking about a spiritual perspective. Integral, evolutionary, and spiritual. Spirit can mean many things. We're going to recognize spirit has two directions, all the way up, all the way down. So every movement higher means a movement deeper. Every movement deeper, a movement higher. Spirit is just a force. It's an explosion, and the explosion is two directions. One is return to origin. So when in the traditional sense, when we talk about liberation of spirit, we talk about liberation of an impulse that goes back to how things were before the beginning and recognizes that as self. That's significant. That is what source points do. We don't have a lot of time to talk about that. I think on my side I put up a lecture I gave about that. Yeah, I gave a lecture at Sandy Hook Town Hall about Chinese medicine and trauma and I covered source points and whatnot, so that's up on my site. So anyway, so we're talking about the origin of self. This is the part, the dimension of self discovered in meditation. So in meditation, you sit straight. Straight means I'm at the center and I'm not going to move. Straight means, so sitting straight without moving means I'm at the, placing myself at the center. I'm taking a position of no relationship to any thought, feeling, emotion, and sensation that happens out in the wheel. Doesn't matter. I was once sitting meditating in a building with 150 people, and a lightning bolt hit a 100-foot-tall pine tree outside, and it exploded, and nobody moved. Right? So, one time a video camera, I was meditating 3 hours, and a video camera on a tripod fell over just behind me and slammed into a metal chair. And I just figured, okay, doesn't sound like anyone died. And I just let go of it and let the people running the show take care of it and didn't move. So sitting straight, not moving, means I'm taking the position as an act of will. I'm taking the perspective of that consciousness at the center of the circle. And no matter what happens in my awareness, I will have no relationship to it. And if one does this seriously, one will see, oh, everything happening out there isn't me. I'm the one who made this choice to be free. I'm this consciousness at the center. Everything out there isn't me. Everything I thought I was. Everything from April 21st, 7:49 a.m., 1958, till this moment, that's not me. I wasn't born, I'm not, who I am wasn't born and won't die. It's not just this collection of thoughts, memories. When I die, all of that will come apart like a pearl necklace. Right? With all those individual moments of time being let go by this machine that's creating the illusion of continuity. Between them, I am really this unborn, undying awareness. And in that, one discovers there's no problem. Go, oh! Not only isn't there a problem, there was never a problem. There never could be a problem when life is looked at from this dimension of myself. It's not the only perspective, but it's a perspective that's important. So what I've noticed about human beings is most human beings are deeply identified with the notion of a problem, an existential knot at the root of self. And they're spending their whole life trying to overcome that, trying to therapize it, trying to heal it, trying to give that pain what it wants. And the pain keeps telling you, you'll be happy when your mother buys you the new doll. You'll be happy when you get the new slot car. You'll be happy when you get a boyfriend. You'll be happy when you get a girlfriend. You'll be happy when you get into a college. You'll be happy when you graduate from college. And this mechanism is always putting wholeness at some imagined time in the future, but it's never going to be right now. It's always getting ready to be ready. And that's the ego. So the Super Bowl is on. The coin toss has happened. Right? Sperm hit egg. Then you're on the sperm hits egg, you're on the playing field, but you're still in the locker room doing push-ups. You go, come on! Your team needs you. You go, can't you see I'm busy training? I'm really serious about this. You're in the locker room. Go, wait, don't judge me. I'm working on it. Do you see? So we want to wake up. Realize this isn't a dress rehearsal where the game's on. The game's on. It's always been on. It could never be anything but on. And we are, as far as we are the one player on the field. Right? Because there's just one thing happening in the universe at any moment. So spiritual means the recognition of that. It means recognizing the motives of spirit, and the spirit is two motives, to return to origin and straight ahead toward the true, the good, the beautiful. Higher, higher, higher. Things are perfect as they are right now, and I'm the vehicle for making them better. That's the duality we have to hold. Things are perfect as they are right now. There's no problem. but I am the vehicle for making them better. Okay? So spirit, return to origin. That's the traditional Eastern view. And then the evolutionary view is higher, 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 higher. More complexity, more integration. The more a human consciousness evolves, the more complexity it can hold. So you look at people who live in tribes, people at a tribal level, historically, every other tribe was the evil other. Right? Every other tribe was the evil other. And you can just see this playing out in the world today. Now, the American Indians who live in tribes now, many of them aren't at a tribal level of development anymore. Right? They have TVs and they have cell phones and they drive Jeeps and they have political organizations and senators and congressmen and they run casinos. That's very far beyond a tribal level. But if you look at the tribes who are still in the world, like the Hutus and the Tutsis, right? Or, Hutus and Tutsis work, I mean. Or for instance, the Pakistanis and the Indians, I mean, the same freaking people. You know the difference between the Hutus and the Tutsis? The shape of the forehead. The same people. And between the Pakistanis and the Indians, what's the difference? The difference is 700 years ago, one person walked into a Muslim church and another person walked into a Hindu church. It's the only difference. They're genetically, they're the exact same people living in the same place. So the thing about tribes is everyone else is an evil other, but then you get to a nationalistic level, that's a higher level of development culturally, right? Because at a national level, it's not just you're black and I'm white. At a nationalistic level, we're all Americans, right? But at a nationalistic level, it's like America right or wrong. That's kind of a low level of development. Then you reach a world-centric level, you see yourself as a citizen of the world. Most people in here probably are at a world-centric level of development. In terms of nationalism, the most deeply I can possibly relate to it is when I watch the Olympics, I'm a little happier if the American wins. But if the American loses, I'm not going to commit suicide, right? You get people who would if their team lost, right? And I would have hated to have been a Russian athlete who didn't win a medal. That would be a real bummer. But so the higher consciousness goes, the more inclusive it is. The higher consciousness evolves, the more you're able to recognize self and other as self. Self as other and other as self. You see? So the more complexity you can hold. Okay, so there are different dimensions of the self. Emptiness. Empty. Okay, I'm being told we need a break, but it's going to be a few minutes. So, different dimensions of the self. Emptiness is the part of you where nothing ever happened. For many of us in this room, that may be a philosophical construct, and we may never have experienced that. And when we have experienced it, we might not have found the meaning in it that we should have. But you as a vehicle are a portal to eternity. You're a portal, you're connected, your consciousness is connected to eternity. And there's a significant dimension who you are that has no problem. Nothing to overcome. It isn't wounded, traumatized, victimized. Nothing happened there. What I call the authentic self is the part of you that's exploding out of emptiness. It's the impulse toward the true, the good, the beautiful. It's the part of God that when God spent 14 billion years to create big lizards and a meteor hit the earth and they all died, do you think God said, oh my God, 14 billion years, I got to go to Kripalu and... I got to talk about this and do a dyad. God would have had no one else to talk to, so he would have had to say, well, how do I feel about this? I think God's attitude was, okay, we're going with the mammals. That would have been how long it took, right? Straight ahead, God would just be this impulse toward the true, the good, the beautiful. So that's a part of you too. There's a dimension of the self which always cares more for your responsibility to others than it does about your own suffering. So you can see that in Christopher Reeves, who played Superman and he was paralyzed. He just cared more about the effect he could have in the world. It was just straight ahead, okay, this is what I've got, but I'm going to use it for everyone else. Same thing with Nelson Mandela, same thing with Gandhi and Martin Luther King and all these people we idolize and respect. But it's one thing to put their pictures up on the wall and worship them, and that can be a way of being cynical about your own responsibility for doing the same thing. The ego is I define strictly, the ego is not the personal sphere of experience. It's the machine, the mechanism that creates the illusion that all you are is the personal sphere of experience. Yes. The ego is, when I say ego, I don't mean the personal self. I mean the mechanism inside that creates the illusion that all you are is the personal self. The ego is the filter that keeps consciousness focused only on I, me, and mine. It isn't I, me, and mine. It's a particular relationship to it that denies the universal dimensions of experience, like emptiness, like the creative impulse. There's the soul. The soul I will define as the deepest, best part of the self that aspires. It's the deepest part of you that is still relative but closest to the universal and aspiring to the universal. And the soul has a condition, and the condition of the soul is determined by everything you've experienced, every choice you've made in relationship to your experience, and everything your people have experienced and the choices they've made in relationship to it. So the condition of my soul at the moment would be a consequence of every choice I've made in this incarnation in relationship to what I know. Ignorance distorts the soul, but what distorts the soul even more is knowing the right thing to do and not caring. And the worst thing is to know that you don't care and not care that you don't care. That's what a psychopath, like serial killer. A serial killer isn't someone who doesn't know the right thing. They just don't care. They know the right thing, and they know what they're doing, and they don't care that it's wrong. They're going to do it anyway. Yes, ma'am. Yeah, so as a Jew, I'm responsible for, as a Jew, I have conditioning in my soul relative to what the Jewish people have experienced historically. I have that through culture and I have it genetically. And I'm also responsible for the actions that Jews are taking in the world.
So I'm anxious because I've been persecuted. I'm Jewish too, I just want to say. Really, tell me.
That's all right.
Just more. Yeah. You're saying, like, so my people are offended or something, so in some way embedded in my DNA.
Well, we can drop Jews. Just you have genetic and cultural conditioning as a woman. I have it as a man. There are significant attributes of both of our personality which are given by physiology at the moment of conception. There are constructs. There are ways of looking at the world that are just in the template. Just in the template. And then those tend to... So throughout history, those have been unconscious and have dictated culture, and culture has come to reinforce those differences. But now we're at a point of cultural evolution where we can actually see those and influences, genetic and cultural, and then start saying, does that make sense? Do I want to live my life like that? Do I want my actions to be determined by just genetic influences that are reinforced by culture and the template? Or do I have higher values that I want to realize that are going to require me to use my willpower and my consciousness to overcome my genetic and cultural conditioning? Do you see? Yes, sir.
My question is, do you feel like there is a specific dimension of self wherein sort of need or where aspiration exists, or when I think of ego, I think of need, the creation of need, the proliferation of need. But
ego, so I would not define ego as need. I would define ego as a specific kind of relationship to need, which would be an unconscious relationship where I'm feeling a need and I'm victimized by it, so I either have to fulfill it or suppress it. Ego to me would be a mechanism that causes you to identify with a need just because you're having it. I really wanted that jelly donut this morning, and I either ate it, and now I'm a victim of having eaten it physiologically, or I didn't eat it, and now I'm going to make you a victim of the fact that I couldn't have the jelly donut. So I would see ego more as a quality of relationship to experience, not the fact of an emotion, feeling, thought existing.
The second half of my question is about being uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
And as that may be a driving motivation to continue to aspire toward, you know, the things that you associate with emptiness that you had described. This discomfort, is this easily confused with the needs that are identified with ego?
I'm not following the question.
Okay,
just ask in another. Give me an example.
Okay. Say someone wants to find capital S self. Okay.
Yeah.
And they have a motivation to do that.
Yeah.
What keeps them uncomfortable enough to keep doing that as they continue to get more closer to that realization?
It's an excellent question. So the question is, if I'm exerting will as a seeker, am I in fact denying the very fact that who I am is actually, what I'm looking for is actually what's looking?
Yes.
Yes. Well, that's the case. So the path and the goal are one. And what the finder has learned is that what was seeking was only ever looking for itself. And this is the foundation of everything from the Iliad to the Wizard of Oz. I mean, this is just a theme in world literature from time immemorial that, you know, what is seeking is looking for itself. And we make a mistake by externalizing that out in the world and seeking for, on the most materialistic level, I'm seeking, you know, sex, money, power. And then on the spiritually materialistic level, I need another retreat, I need more ayahuasca, I need more tantric sex, I need another facial. Well, you know, whatever it is, I need to have my nails done, I need to read more Rumi. But the thing, the hunger inside, the very the thing that caused you to give up this weekend and come here is seeking for something. And it externalizes it, hoping that to find that somewhere out in the world, in a book, in a teacher, in something, and something. And then that is a denial of the fact that you just want to put all your attention on what's seeking. You want to put all your attention just on the part of yourself that is sincere about looking for it. And then the problem becomes when you happen to find it. So you finally find it in the presence of a person. The traditional myth was that person enlightened you and now you owe your life to them. Do you see? And then you get into all these weird power hierarchies, which are very, at a postmodern level, just don't work. So you, when you do become a finder, you certainly want to have deference to whoever helped you find, but never to the point of compromising your own self, because we need a perfect balance of autonomy and communion. Okay, so very quick, we're going to get a break, I promise. So we talked about the soul. The conscience is the voice of the soul. Conscience is the voice of the soul. Don't you think that if you were studying medicine, you'd have classes on like what the soul is, what conscience is, what mind is, what the ego is, what emptiness is, and that your teachers would be really concerned with having you experience this, and they'd be living examples always calling you toward this? Never gets covered. And that, I'm not making any statement about the New England school. It's not covered anywhere in any kind of education, mainstream in culture. Right? Right? It's very rare teacher who will bring you to all that. To me, it's the foundation of it. All the like yin-yang stuff just serves that.
I had the pleasure of my dad, at 60 years old, every night, sat me down when I go to bed, and today you're going to examine your conscience. And I had to do it verbally for a period of time, so I didn't know how to do it. He then would sit at the foot of the bed and be silent every night.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a gift that I wish that every parent would take.
How old is your father now?
He passed away 2 years ago.
How old was he?
90.
Well, see, this is why, because your father was in at a traditional level of development. Probably tradition, somewhat modern, but very traditional. No postmodern parent ever would have done that. Postmodern parent would have told you, you can do whatever you want, and no one can judge you. And a postmodern parent would do the exact opposite, which would be to tell you should never feel shame and raise you so you should never feel shame. Anyway, you were very lucky to have... Do you do martial arts?
I do not.
No? What do you do other than Chinese medicine? Do you have a discipline?
Well, I'm a student now. I had a different career in a different field, but I've always been drawn to this.
Do you do sports?
Yes, I ski and
snowboard. Okay. It's just that the way you were raised, I would expect a very strong amount of discipline.
I did. I've been self-employed since 1981.
Okay, good. Well, you were lucky. It's very rare. So moving on quickly. So conscience is the voice of the soul. And conscience as the voice of the soul is the voice in your head that's always informing you of the nature of the gap between the highest you've seen and how you're actually behaving. So conscience as the voice of the soul is always pushing you to close the gap, to find deep and higher meanings in your experience, and to live up to the highest truth that you profess to believe in and becoming a living example of it. So conscience speaks to you when you have a value, but here's where you are. Your value's here, but you're actually acting like this. And conscience tells you the nature of the gap and is pushing you to close it. What I'm calling the mind is an evolutionarily evolved structure that's a function of the human nervous system. It stores thoughts, it stores memory and retrieves memory. So the mind stores memory and retrieves memories, and it stores them in the form of thought, feeling, sensation, emotion, and conclusion. And conclusions are the way we create connections between thoughts, feelings, emotions, sensations, and memories. So our conclusions are what ties them all together into a web of construct about who we are and how life is. So mind is good, but it makes a good servant and a terrible master. Because the contents of the mind are always inherently limited. So if we're responding to life from the mind, we're always responding from an inherently limited context. Right? So we want to let in these infinite dimensions of the self, of emptiness and the authentic self. Emptiness, the authentic self, is this explosion toward the true, the good, the beautiful. They're both infinite, they're both absolute. When I use the word consciousness, I'm just referring to the field, the universal field, that mind, conscience, soul, ego, authentic self, and emptiness are occurring within. So all these former things, emptiness, authentic self, ego, soul, conscience, mind, are occurring in consciousness, and consciousness is aware of them, potentially aware of them. Now, for most people, consciousness is identified with ego, and that's it. Consciousness is identified with a small individual sphere of self, and that's it. We want things to expand. We want the soul, and we don't want soul to be some intellectually abstract thing. We want to know it. How can we be practitioners of a holistic medicine if we don't know the dimensions of ourself that are emptiness, pure positivity, the pure positivity of the evolutionary impulse? If we have no relationship to soul, to conscience, how can we practice a medicine that is inclusive of every dimension of the human being in front of us? We can't. We criticize doctors for seeing people symptomatically. Thinking about someone as earth, or thinking about somebody as spleen chi deficiency, or arrogant liver rising, is just another intellectually abstract way of objectifying a human being. It's no different than thinking about someone as polycystic ovarian syndrome. It's no different at all, necessarily. So, as a person becomes aware, the subject becomes an object. When we're lost out in this circle, we're the subject. The thoughts, feelings, emotions, sensations, conclusions are who we think we are as subject. And then when we go back to the center of that circle, we can see them as an object. All those things become an object in our awareness. Now, when I'm speaking to you, I'm just speaking from my experience. This isn't intellectually abstract to me. I've meditated, 5,000, 10,000 hours, a lot of hours. And it's not my practice anymore. I do it just a little. I do Qigong now, which I've been doing on and off since I took my first class with Bob Flaws in 1980 on Qigong, and I've been doing it since then. And my other practice was martial arts, which I did 27 years. Now my practice is Qigong. But you want to do some meditation. Should be a central part of practice. Have to discover that part of yourself. Then you have to be in relationship with people who are going somewhere. Right? You're going somewhere with them, so we're all going somewhere together. So, okay, these are the dimensions of the self. We want the subject to become an object, and that's a medical principle. We want our patients to gain objectivity on their patterns so they can the patterns start occurring in their awareness and they have more freedom to make higher choices in relationship to them. So let's take a 15-minute break. Thank you very much.